This is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. We're on monthly, the first Thursday of every month. And this is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, Hudson, Columbia, and Greene counties. And we're global on WGXC.org. So many people around the world are listening in right now. And we have two guests. We're going to talk about, well, I'm going to talk less, and our guests are going to talk more. And Taylor Larson is an author. She's here. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Chris Freeman is here also.
Hi, I'm really glad to be here.
Both residents of Hudson, actually, which is pretty interesting. And I'm going to go to Taylor first. And today's actually, just moments ago, is my first time meeting Taylor. So welcome. She's written a novel, which was released last year. And it's on Huffington's number one best summer reads. Isn't that true?
It is.
That's pretty awesome.
Thanks.
And your book is Stranger, Father, Beloved. Can you give us a synopsis?
Sure. The premise of the story is a man sees his wife talking with a stranger at a party, and he becomes obsessed that this is the man she should have married instead of himself. So he begins a campaign to replace himself and the family with the stranger by bringing the stranger in so that he can leave. And chaos ensues.
Mm. Gripping. And Chris has brought some stories to read today. And yeah. And Chris, what has inspired your writing?
Well, I've written most of my life, but I never really took it seriously until 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, when I drove my partner to his deathbed in Michigan. We started the drive because he needed to get to his family. That was the only thing on his mind. He begged me to take him there. I'm not even sure if it was legal because he was dead 5 days later. Hmm. So the trip was about driving with imminent disaster. And it was about the amazing insight I found to love with this man. Hmm. And the gifts that we were given together while not speaking just about the whole time.
Hmm.
So I started writing through that, and that pretty much informs my writing today, where it's all set very much within something that could be called disaster, or something that could be a scenario or circumstance that's unsafe, but doing it in a place where fear doesn't exist and where I found a complete freedom. That's when I started writing really seriously.
Great. I mean, and you are you have multi-talents, filmmaker, painter, and it's great. You have no bounds, I would say, as an artist.
Yeah, seems like that. It's a little bit of a problem. I'm just writing and painting these days.
Good. Yeah. And Taylor, what's your background? In how did you get to where you got to write this book?
Oh, well, that would take up the whole program, so I'll try to... But I started this about 12 years ago in undergraduate, actually, and worked on it through graduate school and after, and then took a long time for me to get an agent. But I finally did, and I never gave up. But it was really, a lot of energy to get to this point. So I'm just thrilled to do stuff like be on the radio and have people read my book. It was a long road, but... So I've been with this material for over 12 years. I know this guy and all these characters pretty well. They're like friends at this point. So
let me ask you the title Stranger, Father, Beloved. Who does that relate to?
Well, it relates to several characters in the book, but there's actually a funny story with, if you want to hear it, about how we came up. My agent, we had a different title, which it's too embarrassing for me to admit to because it was really bad. So my agent said, we need a new title. I said, I agree. And so we were going back and forth with titles over email. And I just brainstorming, and I said, "Aha, too bad that Camus took The Stranger. You know, such a good title. Ha ha ha." And she said, "Oh yeah." And then I thought of, "Oh, Beloved, one of my favorite books. Mm. Too bad Toni Morrison took that one. Ha ha." And we knew we wanted Father in there. You're originally going to have the Latin name for Father. I don't even know how to say it, which is embarrassing on the radio. Pater, which was totally pretentious. I'm so glad we didn't do that. We came up with Stranger, Father, Beloved from my favorite book titles. That's the story. And also it refers thematically to, basically it's sort of the dissolving of a family. And so it starts with the premise, as I said, of the father observing the stranger, but what does it mean to be beloved? And there's a lot of secrets in the book about love that come to light by the end. So,
well, I'll tell our listeners my idea for the next hour, what I would like to do. And that is to have Taylor read a pretty good section. I kind of want it to be, you know, kind of you're sitting at home, our listeners, and they're relaxing and they want to know more. It's kind of like an audiobook situation. Cool. So I'm going to ask Taylor to read a good chunk, as much as she wants, and then we'll go to Chris and we'll do the same thing. And then we'll regroup and talk a little bit together about what we just heard both of you talk about.
So, sounds great.
Taylor, you're now on stage.
Okay. This is the second half of the first chapter. It takes place in the party scene where Michael first observes the stranger. So I'm reading the last few pages of chapter one. Then he was back outside in a dark yard. Nancy had lit little candles, just as they had planned, and the air was lovely and warm, the lighting flattering to everyone, equalizing them all in an image of God's beauty. All faces could bend and slant into something nice to look at if just given a kind and delicate light. Michael's friends were young men again in this light, and the women were dangerous beings, deliciously different from them, whom they loved to watch glide around. His wife was not among the nymphettes, so he went inside to find her. Michael found Nancy sitting on a chair in the living room, talking earnestly with the man from the bathroom. The man sat across from her on a yellow armchair that matched hers in color and fabric, and they both had wicked grins on their faces. They sat next to a small table with a blue glass lamp on it that cast a soft, intimate glow on their faces. The light seemed to separate the pair from the world around them. Michael thought of going up to them and entering their pleasant conversation, but then thought better of it. They were speaking in such a way as to stop him in his tracks. Time was moving slowly in their corner of the room. Nancy was leaning comfortably forward on her elbows. Michael saw that his wife was grinning with an ecstatic happiness, and he knew he had never before elicited from her such a response of unrestrained joy. She appeared to him a different woman from the one he had married. The man was studying Nancy as she spoke, clearly amused by her, his lips parted ever so slightly, hanging on her every word, as if they were sharing a secret. Nancy would occasionally laugh with her head cocked back, a wild gesture Michael was sure he had never seen in her before. He was amazed to see her so animated, so unself-conscious. A stab of jealousy coursed through him, and then just as quickly it vanished, leaving only a sense of wonder. The weight that normally coated Nancy's face seemed to have miraculously left her features. They were sharp and bold, and a sense of preciousness clung to her, surrounded her. Her hands seemed more delicate, her mouth and eyes more alive, more passionate. Michael was sure that she had never looked like this, never once, until now. It was at that moment that Michael realized, without a doubt, that this was the man Nancy should have married. The energy around them was electric. And as he watched them, he felt a strange shaking sensation rising up from his legs. This realization was immediate, could not be explained, and could not be refuted by anyone. He had never in his life been more certain of anything. Their two bodies were meant to be joined. To her credit, Michael was sure that the man was someone she had just met and toward whom her intentions were totally innocent, yet he still saw it. At that moment, something restless that had been previously undefined began to crystallize inside Michael. He could feel his molecules realigning. As people shifted around him, mingling and murmuring, he kept his eyes focused on the two of them. It was really quite beautiful to witness such a match perch before him. He wanted secretly to clear out all the guests, tiptoe to the door, and lock it behind him, sealing the two of them in a private world they could explore together. He knew if they were left alone in a timeless realm, they would go on talking forever, or at least late into the night until they fell asleep together. And their sex would be beautiful and innocent, like two teenagers having their first time on a bed of sheets and covers they made in the woods. Michael stood transfixed, smiling at the thought. At the party's end, Michael stared outside at the lamppost, which lit up a section of the driveway, and left the rest in darkness. It was getting colder. The spring nights still had their chill. Stray fog was drifting through his yard, as it always did. He could see an occasional flicker as it blanketed the light post. The clouds moved quickly out here, over the rocky coasts and dark, cold waters surrounding their peninsula. The sky was constantly in motion with charged gray matter. Above, a mass moving purposely forward. Below, playful swirls of mist skipping over the houses and trees, causing mischief. Some of Rhode Island was tacky, but this little strip of land was positively wild and elegant, he felt, like an old English marsh. If he got too caught in his head, he knew to come outside. The cool, wind-filled air always dissipated his anxiety, the paranoia that had marred his life. It was like an evil growth, a malignancy that clung to his side and made thoughts arrive in his mind at a different timbre from regular people's. The paranoid brain was fast and often perceived an innocent look or comment as mocking or cruel. Hints were amplified and meanings distorted. Talking with other people could be a horrifying experience, though Michael could usually pass for normal. Most of the pain was internal, a private hell that his silent, brooding twin offered up daily tickets to. To make matters worse, the older he got, the less his medication seemed to work. It still put a sheath over about 35% of the anxiety, but the rest stayed strong and functional, doing what it did best. But coming outside seemed to free him from the dark mass and the dark mind, and the elements of wind, water, and earth pulled him away from himself. There were the pine trees, the sea-misted air, the sounds of the water on stormy nights, all the little animals and birds, hawks and owls, that moved around the outside of his house, securing shelter and adapting to the moods of the atmosphere. In a sense, it was unnatural to live in a solid house that was never affected by the weather. If he had been an animal or lived in a house that was not sealed with sterility, his mind might have been freer and less paranoid. The salt air would soothe the malignancy, coax it away into the night. In his study, Michael could hear Nancy cleaning up in the kitchen and could not bring himself to go and help her. Looking out into the hallway, he could see the blaze of lights at the other end of the hall. Nancy always cleaned with every single light turned on, so that each square inch could be scanned and no detail missed. The overheads were blaringly electric and hurt his eyes. Michael knew his wife was avoiding him, as he could turn hateful from drinking. Or, he thought, maybe she wanted to be alone. Maybe she was thinking of the man she had talked with at the party. He closed the door to the study and settled into his burgundy leather chair. He pulled out his secret bottle of scotch and poured some into the glass he held, which still had ice at the bottom. An excitement tinged with anxiety burned in his stomach as flashes of Nancy talking so flirtatiously with the other man lit up his mind. He would give her this gift for so many of the wasted years she had spent as his wife. Though he was excited, the alcohol slowed his mind down with each sip. He had Alex's essay in his lap, but he was too disoriented to begin reading it tonight. He reached up and snapped off the standing lamp next to his leather chair. The room was mostly dark. Miraculously, he found himself going in and out of dreams. More miraculous still, his wife had gone to bed, had not rapped on the door to see what he was up to. When he awoke from a deep sleep, it was 3 a.m. That was quite an accomplishment, sleeping for a few hours. Out of habit, he stood from the chair and made his way to the stairway to the second floor to join his wife in bed. Perhaps he could get 1 or 2 more hours of sleep. His mind was foggy enough to allow it. Sliding face first onto the massive bed, he stretched out on his half of the mattress. She knew not to come to his side.
Wow.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you. I'm just going to let that soak in for a few seconds.
Oh, thanks.
So we'll come back to our interesting story. I can't wait to hear a little bit more. So I'm going to go to Chris and have Chris read for a while.
Well, I'm just getting over her knowing not to go to his side of the bed.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. Okay. This is a longer piece because you wanted a longer piece. It's called Hairy Chest. I'm going to move this mic a little bit.
That's good.
We got in the car in the middle of an argument. I was strapped in already before the alarm was going off, and she was yelling at me about it. But I was busy backing out, my mask half covering my eyes and all, waiting for the garage door to open all the way, sweating, not able to breathe. The car was pretty full of exhaust. I realized there was still a hose coming in from the exhaust pipe through the back window. That's probably what caught the attendant's eye. I put it there earlier in case we were caught. We could lock all the doors and have an escape. I didn't see him anymore in my rear view after I backed out and couldn't think about anything else besides, we gotta get out of here. So at a certain point, I put it in drive and hammered down, opened the windows, breathed out. She took off her glasses and mustache and put them on the floor, told me to slow down and not get all fidgety or else we're gonna look suspicious again. I told her to grab the wheel while I took off my inflatable fat suit, which got stuck around my ankles, but she held the car going straight. Push on the gas some with your hand, we're slowing down, she said. I got the suit off but lost the shoe in the middle of it, tossed it out the window around the next turn while she peeled off her fake hairy chest and put on a white t-shirt instead. She showed me her boobs, then she grabbed the money. You like me with big or small ones, she asked. I like them small, I said, which made her smile. So she opened the bag and showed me all the cash. Must have been at least $1,000 in there. Free, I thought. We're free now, I said. She said, screw you, this is my bag, yours is in the back. So grab it, I said. She flipped around to get to the back seat and I grabbed her ass cheek until she punched at me to let go. It was good timing anyway, as the tunnel was coming up. I better pay attention. So I straightened the car out and she opened the bag. What was inside was strobe lit by the lights of the tunnel. In it was someone else's wig and an envelope. She picked up the wig and said, you should have given that lady her wig back. But I needed it. You shouldn't have taken off her from the start. Well, she had it coming, I said, getting all upright with me like that. She was the nurse, she said. You shouldn't have taken her sandwich either. I don't know why you do those things. I guess she wigged out, I said. Maybe I shouldn't have, I thought. But instead, I said, I was hungry and tired of her authority charade. Anyway, in the paper bag was a picture of my mom and dad. She pulled it out along with the sandwich I took from that lady. And in there, next to the wig, was a note I forgot to leave them that said, I love you, and I wish I could be with you all the same, but I just don't see that happening anymore, and for a lot of reasons. She started to ask me something, but stopped, so I said, I know. I just couldn't find a place to leave the note. I didn't expect to find my parents laying there naked with tags on their toes. I didn't expect that. And no matter how much I tried, I couldn't revive them either. Once again, ever since I was a kid, I couldn't bring them back to life. You caused a lot of upheaval there, she said. Well, I didn't appreciate the guards grabbing me while I was trying to revive my parents. Okay, she said, I get that. But so you know, those weren't your parents. They were your siblings. And your parents weren't dead either. They were trying to stop you and the mouth-to-mouth thing. No, those were guards, I said. And yeah, I was pretty focused on helping them the best I could is all. Besides, what else was I supposed to do? Well, I'm not sure if they needed mouth-to-mouth since your brother and sister were just laying there reading and waiting on lunch with your parents. That's why I left, you know. I don't know why I went back in the first place. To be honest with you, I figured that if they didn't recognize you or me, I could help them. She pushed up on both her breasts and said, I'm glad you got to at least say something to them. I liked your wording. To apologizing for all that you did or didn't do, it was a good note. She smiled and went on to say, but it was quite a scene, I have to say. I guess that's why the lady there just gave you their money. It was all so surprising. Maybe she just wanted you to leave. Maybe she was just tired of you showing up, not able to be yourself. Remember, I was trying to tell you about the costumes, that they'd know. that they'd see you right through them. Then she found another envelope in the bag. She opened it and read it aloud. It said, "Dear son, we've always loved you and always done our best. For all that we've done, nothing personal, okay? So in the meantime, we're leaving you $1,000 to help out finding an apartment, and we've made sure they had a sandwich here for you when you came to visit us here at Happy Landing. We hope this helps, as we just don't think it's a good idea for you to be living in our car any longer. This might be a good time for us to express that we'd appreciate it if you stopped trying to save us all the time. Clearly, you've tried everything you can think of, and we see that. But it's really time you save yourself, don't you think? So just slow down and don't worry about us today, as we are with you and always will be, just so you know." I looked at my hands on the wheel and the sandwich in my lap and took my foot off the gas some. I thought for a minute that the note might have been written by the guards to keep me out of there, that the sandwich was probably poison, but then figured I should just keep driving and try to believe them for once. And just then the tunnel ended and we were overwhelmed with light. Felt like a new day. She pulled her t-shirt back down and said, "Here, let go of the sandwich. I'll squirt on some of this mayonnaise."
Beautiful.
I know. Another pause needs to be absorbed. Taylor, what did you think of what Chris just wrote?
Read? It's so good. It's so surprising and fresh and tight. It's very, one second to the next, I felt like the narrative voice was very clear, and I kept being surprised in a pleasant way, but didn't put me off at all. I was just fascinated by these people, actually.
Yeah, I definitely have questions about, you know, this. It's almost like like Taylor did earlier, she read a portion, and this seems like a portion, Chris, of something greater. There's a lot of backstory that I'm curious about.
Perhaps a novel?
That could be. What made you write that?
It's the same thing, I think, that makes me write everything, and I'm not very good at writing most of the time. I can write a lot of stories, and then they just kind of become one. It's really all just sort of thoughts at the moment, something that comes. But what I really love is how supportive the characters are of one another in these circumstances. They're not attacking one another. They're just sort of helping each other out or coming to some really heavy self-realizations about each other or themselves. I think a lot about how things don't have to be perfect in my life and I can be okay. So I think having lived with severe circumstance, with my partner being very ill for a long time, crisis after crisis, many times where I was told he's dying now, all those moments where I had to go to just being selfless, not having been in a place of fear, just really thinking about this other person, it just opened the door to all these other thoughts that could come to me. And it kind of came out of something I read by Giorgio Morandi. He's a painter. He's a really great painter. He wrote, this pretty much is why I write, I think. It's funny to find it. I taped it to my wall so I can read it every morning just to confirm myself, I guess. But he said, "I believe that nothing can be more abstract, more unreal than what we actually see. We know that all we can see of the objective world as human beings never really exists as we see and understand it. Matter exists, of course, but has no intrinsic meaning of its own, such as the meanings we attach to it. We can know only that a cup is a cup and that a tree is a tree." And so for me, I understand this very much about what relationships are, you know, relationships to loved ones, relationships to daily living, relationships to painting, relationships to fear. What is the right thing for me to do? They come out of that. I don't have any other explanation, really.
Well, you both must at least have to let go of a part of you to then give voice to characters that may or may not be real. And it must, you know, I'm not a writer, but I find in both of what you've read so far is the description of being able to take the reader or the listener up to a place that they've never been to before. That's, I think, quite an art form there.
I kind of wanted to ask Larson, like, you know, when you're writing, you're alone, and it's a great place to be isolated and in some other world, but it's kind of new to me to be thinking about what the other person would say. You know, that's kind of a trip. It's a little schizophrenic. And one that I think I'm getting better at. How do you deal with that? You have a lot of that going on in your novel there.
You mean the being alone while writing, or just the loneliness that also comes into the character, all of it, you mean?
Well, being in many people's heads and trying to figure out what they're going to say to the other person.
Well, I'm a big believer in, it's like a courtship with the characters. So, I mean, obviously I'm in control on some level because I'm, but I wait till an idea or a character really excites me. And then I'm going to teach my students this too. It's like a courtship where I wait for them to start coming to life and I have to be actively involved. But for a while, then they take on a life of their own. I'm not a believer in like sitting there and making things up. And a lot of definitely my own personal experiences too with my struggles, and definitely all of my characters feel very alienated. And that's something I've felt. There's also shame is a big one. It comes out in a bunch of different ways. So it's just touching off of some of the things you shared. But yeah, I'm a big believer in, so it's kind of, I've talked about this before, like it's really exciting, I think, to hear the character speak. And then sometimes, usually the books I write are really painful, and then to go really deep into their pain is, like you said, it's kind of schizophrenic in the sense that you go to such a high place of the joy of creating and the excitement of getting to know this person, and then going deep into their pain is, and then you're just alone, you know, by yourself doing it. And it's, that's why I crave this kind of interaction, because so much of my time is
alone.
And a lot of my characters are sort of coming apart and hanging on by a thread, which is interesting. So, but what about you? You said it's new to you to be, well, 4 years you said you've been writing.
Yeah. Well, I didn't feel like I was doing something strange, maybe, until a friend was watching me write, and I didn't know they were there, and I was laughing hysterically over what this other person was doing to the other guy. And he was like, you know, you're not supposed to laugh at your own writing.
I disagree. Like I think my stuff's hysterical. I think it's part of the joy of it, too, to
totally
laugh.
Right.
I walk around like a raving lunatic. I'll cry. I have a bathrobe on. I walk around the house and, you know, get really worked up and really sad, really happy. I think that's completely normal and actually a good sign.
Well, it was definitely a shame moment that I had to get over.
That's
but my dog is really sympathetic with me, you know, because, like, I'm not even interacting with the dog, and he's like, okay, he's crying again, you know. Yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah, you know, my brain works very quickly. I don't know how I could slow it down to actually write. And Taylor, you sort of gone through this process of going to school and learning how to write, and I mean, I wouldn't know how to slow down to actually get those thoughts down on paper. Is there a sort of a technique that you use?
Well, it's definitely a craft. I mean, for me personally, I mean, I've known plenty of writers that didn't go to school and get trained, but the only way that I understood how to do it was to do a lot of conscious training of like learning the characterization and talking about it in a very conscious way. And eventually, hopefully, the skills after a certain number of years sort of click in on auto, and then the juicy subconscious percolates up and informs, and that's where all the great ideas come from. So I mean, of course, like I tell that to my students and they're like, what, you know, like wait for your subconscious to tell, you know. But that's why we do all the work of really like talking it out and analyzing it, so we can eventually click that off and trust skills. So
but you also need that practice.
You have to practice, yeah.
Just the technique even in being able to write really fast. Mm-hmm. Like it took me a long time to stop looking at the keys and to just look at the desktop, you know. And then eventually not looking at the desktop, which I think is what you're talking about. And all of a sudden you're just in the ideas. And, you know, at this point, after all that practice, I mean, I've been writing physically for about 10 years, you know, and tons of practice of just writing to the point of, like, now I'm, like you were saying, there's a moment, there's the discipline of writing where you have to sit down whether you feel like it or not, or it's not going to get done. So you get through that, and then you actually get to some ideas that seem half okay. And then, like you said, it turns into its own thing. But for me, I had to know how to write really fast and not have to look at anything after a while. I could just be now in the room with the characters, and my hands are writing.
Yeah.
And not worrying about the like misspelling or whatever. You get to that later. You know?
Yeah. And once you've revised enough, you trust, you know that you will be able to fix it. So you want to first just get something that's true, that rings true. I mean, I wrote half of a book many years ago that I just wasn't connecting with on a gut level, and I abandoned the project because it was a conceptual book. I thought it was a cool idea, but I wasn't really connected to it. So I agree. Like, and I had one other thing I completely forgot. I'm so in the moment. And maybe it'll come back to me. But yeah, I am trusting the process and having fun with it. But yeah, I think the first 40 pages of a new novel is really hard. It's sort of like jumping off a cliff because you're just sort of trusting that there's a world here, and you're kind of waiting and hoping that it is all. You basically have to just trust yourself. But yeah, it's a lot of practice and a lot of people. I think a lot of times people think of writers as like they just sat down and like poured out something, and they're like, a lot of people are really intimidated by, I think, writing, and they think that some people are just endowed with this gift, but it's a lot of hard work, and that's what I try to tell my students, because people are sort of, they think if it doesn't come out right the first time, I don't know if what you think about all this, it's just really a lot of work, like what you're saying. It's just like endless revision, probably revise this book 100 times. So people, if you're up to that, then I would encourage doing it. If not,
it's an amazing process too of being honest with yourself. For me, it's a constant revision in how would I actually do this, you know, getting beyond like what I think I should say, what somebody else wants me to hear, something I've heard before, like really getting beyond all that to finally like, well, who am I, you know, how would I actually really act here? And that really takes going in, you know, it's like an indwelling. That's a really amazing place when it starts to happen, and it doesn't happen all the time. And so when it's happening, like everything has to, I can't do anything else. I have to just do that because it's very, very special. You know, it's almost like a spiritual moment where you are in an alternative reality. You just are. And, you know, you got all your skills together and here we go, you know. But for me, the best part, I meet so many people have the greatest dialogue, and I ask them, do you write? And nobody really writes. It's like something people don't do. But if people would just write the way they speak and think normally without adding anything, without looking at thesaurus, nothing, just writing the way they speak, there'd be a lot of really great writers out there.
Well, and you have a couple more stories. I'd like you to, Chris, pick another one for us.
Should I read two short of short ones?
Yeah.
How do you want me to do this?
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to end with kind of this four-minute-long one.
Okay.
All right. Well, this one's called Lotto Drawing. It was a drawing of the lotto ticket. Took me like 3 weeks. Drew day and night like my life depended on it, mostly because it did. There wasn't anything else, really. That was all. And my marker was drying out, ran out of tape, got a smudge on one side. What a complete disaster. But when the girl put it under the scanner, it won. I said, what? Looking up from the napkin dispenser after pulling out a few and looking into the cheeseburger spinning around on the showcase. She said, you won. Huh, I thought. Imagine that. I didn't really know what to do next, so I took all the money and put it on red down at the casino. $40 billion, all on red. The guy spun the wheel and tossed the marble and bounced around until it landed on what I wanted, what I had driven all that way for. I really didn't think anything else was going to happen anyway, so. And it did double my money, just like that. You should have seen the hairdos surrounding me by then. Girls taking their shirts off right in front of me. Even the guy dressed like Caesar couldn't pull his pants down fast enough when I was walking toward him. But really, I was just walking to the gift shop. The fact was that I wasn't interested in all that. So I took a look in this catalog and bought myself a wife instead. Right out of the section where the houses are bigger and had hedges all around. She was smiling by the pool, holding a martini in one hand and an album in the other. The cover was of race cars from the 60s, and it was a soundtrack. Just the sound of race cars going around the track, and the announcer saying things like, that Kenny Bates will crash his way to a win if he has to. Or look at Jimmy the Falcon in first place again. That man is on top of the world. I knew she was for me. She was what I didn't even know I was looking for. So I left a message for her, making race sounds with my mouth and nothing else. Sounded pretty good to me, so I left it and felt satisfied. And later on, even though I didn't leave my name or number, somehow I got a message back from her where she did the same thing. She made all these sounds with her mouth. She was having fun and laughed now and then, and I could see her smiling through all she was doing. And that's all it took, I guess. I was in love. Or I really, really wanted to be.
That's cool.
This one's called, more accurately, Skepticism. There was smoke on the road, and beneath the smoke was full of reflections, so I couldn't see a thing, except the lightning going sideways across the sky, making it daylight for as long as it lasted, spelling out in electric letters, "Hey Chris, why don't you fall asleep already?" But I'd been up driving for days and forgot. "I don't want to miss anything," I said, staring through the wipers, flicked my ash on the floor and kept on driving, turned up the radio and cracked the window some. No answer. No follow-through, I thought. But the sky kept lit up, backlighting the spaces between leaves on trees and making a movie, this time with everyone getting killed at the start, while playing with fireworks brought by the favorite uncle, which turned out to be dynamite instead. But it wasn't the concussion of the blast. It was the chrome confetti that overwhelmed them all. The idea that another universe could exist, and in fact may have just then. The only survivor shaking his head no and perching his lips, which as it turns out was the only moment of misgiving, or miraculously, skepticism. And well, you know, the screen goes black for the next hour and a half. Or maybe they all get married and have an unfortunate suffocation while baking the wedding cake, which was really a neurotic end to the obsessive and enslaving behavior of the mother-in-law, working at making the perfect expression on the face of the bride to stand on the cake. And the gas keeps leaking. And then halfway through the movie, the screen goes sun flares and a hand waves in front of the lens, dramatically screaming, "Turn that thing off!" Or, well, then there's getting their tires shut out and a chase scene snuffed, making it easy for the enemy, which may be the one you'd eventually find compassion for. They'd arrest them and take them away, so who knows how long you could sit through that one. And then I got the answer. The sky told me. You can't sleep because all you're doing is getting in the way of what's happening right in front of you, so you might want to take your hands off the rope. The next turn came up and right in front of me, and it didn't take long for the deer to go right through my windshield, the whole kit and caboodle. I felt it come through and made note of the red and brown in her hair, the texture and the feel of the thing, so thick I couldn't get through it. So I watched and thought maybe I could use my fingernail and kind of get under her skin. Maybe I could get through to her that way. So I held her while we were flying through space. And while thinking about that, her back opened up over my head where I was forced to think from then on with my head near her heart. She didn't say much, didn't seem to mind. So we were thrown out of the car wearing her on my head, legs up and head down, guiding me away from the car which was now tumbling down Route 9 and just bounced over an oncoming vehicle filled with young teens having left their first dance party. After winning the big trophy for most creative moves that they had invented themselves at home through necessity, using balloons and marshmallow fluff with open smiles that, without thinking a thing, at once ask you to live with them forever.
There's almost some beat poetry in that, Chris.
You can tell he's a painter, too. The attention it's infused with, and it was the reading and what you said before also reminded. Sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, not at all.
What you said, were saying earlier too, and just hearing your work is, when I get too complicated about all this stuff, or I'm telling my students, all we're doing in the end is telling the truth with grace and love, and the grace is the craft, and the love is, you know, the compassion for the characters and situations. So it's interesting to hear your work. It's like, whenever I get too lost, I'm like, go back to that truth. And you seem to have articulated that really well. So, okay.
I love thinking about, he just went around a corner and a deer came through the windshield and basically blew him out of the back of the car with the deer, you know. Mm-hmm. And the deer went, he's wearing the deer on his head now. That was a really bad accident. Mm. But the amazing part is how he's not part of the accident. He's thinking about her hair. He just met her. He's thinking about maybe he could get to her somehow and calm her down, you know? Mm. And it's when the two of them are together and they're flying through space that he realizes at that point that his car is now bouncing down the highway. It's just rolling like she saved him.
Mm.
Like that relationship saved him, regardless of how difficult it was at first, you know? And then he gets to find these kids who just, they're so young and so amazing that all they want to do is say, well, live with me. I love that.
Mm. Absolutely. And Taylor, I'd like to get to have you read a little bit more.
A little snippet.
Because you started off the hour with an intriguing story that I think we need to revisit.
Okay. This is from the middle of the book. This is when Michael is visiting his mother. So she's elderly at her house in Greenwich, Connecticut. The house had a smell of old wood to it, and Michael walked around the upstairs after his mother was asleep. The floor beneath him creaked, but he knew that nothing except the banging of pots and pans would wake his mother. She slept like the dead now, her bones heavy on the hospital bed that had been moved into the house. The nurses usually bathed her before he arrived, as she liked to preserve her modesty. He got to the door of his father's old room. His father had been a stoic man with distinctive features, and even in his last years, when his face had been rumpled with lines, he had had the features that were unique and dignified. When Michael had seen him in court, he had sat above the others in his black robe, considering the truth as he studied the men and women placed in front of him. He had listened to the lawyers prattle on, unmoved like a boulder, and when he had spoken, the room seemed to tremble. What would it be like to be that confident? Michael occasionally felt a tinge of gratitude that his father was dead, for his life had been spent battling with the man in the subtlest of ways. Growing up, he had felt his father was constantly watching him, as if he were a criminal in his father's courthouse, as if convinced that something was wrong with him. Then, when Michael had had his breakdown at the end of the first year of university, the worst year of his life in many ways, his father had seemed frightened of him. The breakdown had managed to confirm the suspicion that had always haunted their relationship, that Michael was indeed damaged in some unalterable way. It was his mother who had driven him for a trial stay at Chestnut Hill at the start of summer break after his freshman year. It was she who had called him every day and showed no embarrassment for him, at least none that was visible. When they gave him a temporary diagnosis of schizophrenia, one that was eventually changed to neurotic paranoia, an ugly term, but still a better one than the first. She had been at his side and had not broken down into weak tears or turned her head away. She had known all along that he was capable of greatness and had not been daunted by this awful test. Like Nancy, she had nurtured his troubled mind with unconditional love and kindness. The nervous breakdown had come 2 weeks after a night of drinking. Michael had gone to a party where he hadn't known anyone. He had drunk too much and remembered standing in a corner by himself most of the night, listening to others' conversations. Then the night had turned, and he could remember only flashes of it. The next day he had awakened alone on the lawn, and the hangover itself was enough to induce a state of misery. But when he walked around campus, he could feel eyes on him. He had done something wrong, but he could not remember what it was. He didn't know who else had been there. He could not remember how he had gotten home. That seemed a paltry reason to break down, but he felt a strong desire to take a whole bottle of pills, and he found his hands were shaking. He could not even explain it to his one close friend, Alex, who hadn't attended the party. Losing all control in front of a group of strangers had brought him to his knees somehow, emotionally. He could not remember what had happened. When Michael was released from Chestnut Hill, he had gone back to live with his parents for the summer, and the long, empty days had been excruciating. He had insisted on sleeping on the third floor, and when the heat became unbearable, he had felt too embarrassed to complain since he had chosen it in the first place. When his father returned in the middle of the afternoon from the courthouse, Michael would invariably be up on the third floor with his nose buried in either a novel or a book that he was reading for a second-year philosophy class that fall. When Michael passed his father's study to go down to the kitchen, he would often listen outside the door to see if his father mentioned his name while he talked on the phone. He was sure one time he heard his father say, "Living with a lunatic." But he had no proof, as the conversation wasn't even about him. His father had been speaking with an old friend who was a doctor, and they were discussing playing golf that weekend. The comment would have been completely out of context, but it was possible he had said it. Michael then began listening to every comment his father uttered. From upstairs, he would lean over the banister whenever his father spoke to hear if his name was mentioned. His father's tendency to mumble only added to the problem. Once during Christmas that year, his father had left the group assembled by the tree to make himself another scotch and water. Michael had been telling the family a story from school, and his father had left in the middle of it. He could have sworn he said, "Screw you," from the other room under his breath, but he had no proof. If asked, his father would only deny it. Michael stayed at Chestnut Hill for exactly 6 weeks while they tried different medications on him and a lot of talk therapy. He spoke of worrying about what other people thought of him and how, when he was drunk, those worries intensified. By the end of the 6 weeks, they seemed to believe he was stabilized and released him. While he was home for the rest of that miserable summer, Michael had made a decision to overprepare for the coming year and make it the best academic year of his life. He read every single book on the syllabus before classes started so that he could use the actual semester to do outside reading and research on the topics presented. His mother visited the school frequently, and when Michael received his academic awards at the end of the year, she stood in the back of the room in an elegant black dress. She helped him keep track of his prescriptions for Valium, and they tried it in combination with Thorazine to see if it would relieve his anxiety. She adored him and doted on him. Often in their all-night study sessions, Alex and Michael would eat the snacks of crackers and cookies she sent in care packages. She had been so lovely, with her pretty face, nice teeth, stylish clothes and jewelry and long legs. She pinned a diamond brooch to her black dress, simply because he loved the brooch and loved her style. But beyond the beautiful exterior, there was something even better. An authentic, loving spirit, proud of him always, the best of feminine grace that came from mothers.
Thank you, Taylor. So, Taylor Larson has been reading from her first novel, Stranger, Father, Beloved. And what's next for you?
Finished my second book, and I'm revising with my agent, and then we're going to sell it this winter.
Fantastic.
That's a lot to look forward to.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And, Chris, I know... you have another story, and we have about 10 minutes left in the program. Is there enough time to read, or shall we have a little bit more roundtable discussion?
Well, I don't know. I have enough time to read this one. But what I wanted to say about Taylor was it's amazing how you really personified this man's confidence in himself having a mental illness. Mm. Mm. It's like he has this strange... love for it, for how horrible he feels, and so he's not receptive to anybody that loves him. He's only receptive to the idea that he has a mental illness. You know, that was really creepy the way you described all that, and beautifully written.
Thanks.
And the really interesting thing is that it's all just self-imposed. You know, it's all his dialogue with himself, keeping him away from everybody else.
I kind of noticed that when I was reading. I was like, I keep reading these passages where, because there are a lot of passages in the book where he's actually directly interacting with people, but I've chosen these parts that are very interior, so it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I thought you did a great job.
Thanks.
I love how then they release him to himself. And so what he's going to do to have some sort of control is to learn everything in the library. You know, to have some sort of, like, intellectual control. And then I thought, oh, boy, that's not going to have a good end.
You know? It doesn't work very well, no.
Yeah,
I think certainly as we, you know, as we age and we get to know ourselves and other people and see tragedy often sometimes ends up okay and sometimes it doesn't. And I think, I haven't read the book yet, but I think there are probably some lessons there for all of us. And I think that's the power of what the power that both of you have is this description, this taking the reader, the listener, into another world to potentially be that character for a while and feel the joy or feel the pain and feel the questions. It's a valuable artistic tool that both of you have that you're using very well.
Well, thank you, Chad.
Thank you.
And, you know, and Chris is a little bit more abstract, which I like in his writing, because it's like spark plugs often going off, and you know, you're awakened here and there and surprised, and I can't let go because you're holding my attention. And Taylor's a little bit more of a storyline, and I get the same feeling of like Chris just described your writing and the characters. It's
but with Larson's writing, you can close your eyes. I'm sorry, I closed your license. With Taylor's
writing.
I like it.
Keep going with that.
Okay, with Larson's writing, you can close your eyes and just go. I really like that. Mine, you have to kind of keep your eyes open. I think that's the difference.
Well, I think with Freeman's writing, what I like was it's really, my main thing that I look for is someone really bold and takes a lot of risks. And there's this fearlessness with exploring, you know, language that is so refreshing. So you're not afraid to go to another level of, you know, being surreal, and all this stuff is just completely satisfying. So, yeah.
Thank you. Well, can I read another one?
We have just a few minutes. We have 5 minutes left.
This one's 4 minutes.
Oh, that's perfect.
And then we have to say goodbye, right? I'll read a little faster. Do you mind?
Do you want to?
Okay.
I want to hear
No,
it.
No, please.
This one is when I was being Mr. Vice President. So I'm going to put my Vice President voice on. I was going to talk about my career in politics. Stuff you probably don't know about me, like when I was the Vice President. How weird my life was then. I was sleeping all the time, having all these dreams about saving people from being dragged down the street by the wind. Then one day this person blew towards me and was going around my legs over and over, and I was excited because it was such a lonely dream. Anything would be better than being alone. Anything was better than those dreams or being on that street. And then right when I felt, you know, I mean, politics is a lonely place, and the wind just sets the pace, you know, like, it could be a desert with those giant birds that fly above and you're about to die and be eaten, but you're not dead yet, mostly, and you wish you were, because really, you're at a black tie event that's like $10,000 a plate and they're all talking about what concerns them. But it's about commerce or fashion, or like someone is talking about the people this and the people that, and they have cocaine rings around their nostrils, and you really got to look your best. Anyway, yeah, it's all that. And this person is swirling around my legs on the street in Brooklyn a long time ago, way before the police brought drugs to the community. And this person is like, they're my friend. I mean, there is no one, and I mean no one, who is my friend when I'm in politics. Not really. Actually, I was not my friend, and I was not able to be anybody else's friend either. I really sucked, actually. When I was vice president, I really, really sucked. You could say that I was a total asshole, and somehow I felt I was doing the world a service, that I had answers. And when I finally realized that I was the problem and I quit, it took a long time to trust myself again. So, well, they're spinning around my feet in the wind, and for once I'm not alone and I'm happy. But it's not a person, it's actually a balloon. It's a balloon when they lose most of their helium and they don't float anymore, but there's still a string. And as it goes around me, it's scraping the street. It's making that sound of mylar and tar, and it's whirling around my legs like it's in trouble, or that it wants my help, and I can't believe it. I can't believe someone actually wants to be near me. You know, politicians, you don't want to be anywhere near them. I mean, to be honest, I didn't know how to help anyone, and I had no idea how to help myself. Well, that would be me, the lost guy in the street in Brooklyn, in the wind. And well, my friend finally comes to a stop, and then all of a sudden this kid comes around the other side of a car parked on the street. It's a long street with no houses or trees, just dumpsters, miles and miles of dumpsters. And it's me and my friend the balloon, and I see the kid. And I get shameful that I'm feeling something for this balloon, so I step away from it, and then I actually walk, just like I always do. I'm walking away from my only friend in the world, and what does the kid do? He pops my friend. He doesn't just pop it, it takes him a few tries jumping up and down in it to get it to pop. I hear it. I know it needs my help, and I don't do anything. Don't even turn around. Why? Because I'm the vice president, that's why. I'm the worst person in the world. And now, what do I have? A flat Mylar balloon. A flat Mylar balloon that was my friend, and now, I don't have anything.
That was cool. Made me think about a lot of vice presidents. So, we're coming up near the end of the hour. And I just want to remind our guests, we've been talking to Chris Freeman and Taylor Larson. It's been a wonderful hour with the both of you. I'm inspired to think about writing myself. And Chris, you by your comment about being honest with yourself and Taylor's also mentoring, you know, I feel comfortable.
Mm.
You can do it.
I think more people can do it, too. So this has been the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. This is WGXC 90.7 FM. Again, Taylor, her book, Stranger, Father, Beloved. And Chris, maybe you'll be doing some open mic or story slams in the future.
Yeah, at Helsinki.
Cool.
They have a slam fest happening on the 25th.
Fantastic.
I've never done that before. Hopefully it'll work out.
Great.